Trader Jim in Pennsylvania and wherever you are around the world. Thank you for joining us once again. It is time for Light of the Prophets on Truth to You. That's truth number two, letter U.org, where you can sign up for the weekly newsletter and also keep up to date via iTunes, Facebook, and Twitter. I'm Jono, and joining me is Yoel Ben Shlomo. G'day, Yoel.
Good to you too.
Hey, do you know, we had an awesome comment last week, a comment from... It's so good, I want to frame it and put it on my wall. This is from Jeremy from Hawaii.
Hawaii. Yes, I was surprised to discover that as well. I have several friends who live in Hawaii, and I kept on saying Hawaii, 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 and they kept on saying, no, we pronounce it Hawaii. And
isn't that interesting?
I stood there completely puzzled, but I've heard this several times. I actually went online and looked at it a couple of times, and people who live in Hawaii say Hawaii.
They've got an Eskenazi accent, is what you're saying.
That they sound like, yeah, they say Hawaii. It actually does, you're right, it does sound like an Eskenazi, European, Jewish European accent. You're right about that.
How about that? All right, well, Jeremy from Hawaii. No, I can't do that. I'm going to say
Hawaii.
Okay. This is what he had to say. He said, and this is awesome. He said, one of the awesome things that I'm learning to appreciate more and more and definitely grateful for is the well-rounded and typically unbiased approach to the text of Scripture you brothers bring to this program. I enjoy the fact that the desire to know truth is more important than the, quote, box theology of denominationalism. And the only agenda here is obvious, and that's the truth of Yehovah's word being communicated to the people of Yehovah, that we might live for the glory of Yehovah in all that we say, think, and do. I've definitely learned more about the word of my God and who he is in the short time that I've been walking in Torah and becoming a listener of truth to you than I have in the last 10 years. So thank you for being a part of that refreshing oasis, which is Yehovah's word, in a spiritual desert of our world. I praise Yah for you both, and I pray that Yehovah blesses each of you and your families in this work and in the individual work that he has placed you in for the expansion of his kingdom. Wow. What an awesome comment. That is so encouraging. No. Thank you so much, Jeremy, from Hawaii.
Yeah, I read that one as well. I went into the thing and read it. It was like, wow, that's just powerful. So thank you. Really, really, very encouraging. I mean, lately I've been receiving messages from people thanking me, and apparently there's more and more people listening to programs. I mean, I even got an email from someone who listened to one of the first programs we did, and people have actually now started discovering that there's more things that we produced throughout the past, was it 18 months or something, that we've been working together.
That's probably right.
I actually got a question from someone who was trying to understand a certain issue about blood, and he listened to the program that we did literally over a year ago. Wow. And I had to actually go back and look exactly what I said to try to figure out
because that's from, if I remember correctly, we did a program on the issue of the issue of the fat and the blood? Was that what it was called?
Yes, that was the one. That was
and
the
we
one.
Actually get to talk about that in this program.
Maybe a bit. I mean,
a little bit.
Not a little bit. I mean, there's a discussion here about but about issues of sacrifices and temple service and a few things that I will bring up here that go back into interpreting things inside the Torah. There's a few bits and pieces here and there. I also mentioned the issue that we invented the fork and not the Europeans, and I'll point out what I mean.
That's right.
The issue of blood, I mean, the fat and blood is something that a couple of years ago, I actually brought this up in front of a whole group of people, and I brought it up in front of other teachers that I know, and I was surprised that no one actually knew of this. People were aware of blood. I mean, you know, it's in the story of Noah. It's mentioned a few times in Leviticus, and people, you know, just okay, we're gonna sear our steak until it's almost dead again, and trying to avoid the issue of blood. Which, by the way, I mean seriously, I've been going back to the thing I said over a year ago. I've been koshering meat for 22 years. I spent hours in the kitchen with my mother learning how to do these things. Yes, my relationship with kitchens is that old. And I was by the age of 10, I was cooking full meals for the family, literally. I mean, I just keep my mother out of the kitchen. And there's the whole thing. Back in the 80s, when we used to buy meat, it was never kosher. We always bought meat. It was slaughtered and frozen. And we got it from somewhere in South America. Most of the meat here in Israel, most of the beef is from South America. Chicken is raised here in Israel. Chicken is actually the most common type of meat that you will find in Israel. Less beef, more chicken, more poultry. I was koshering piece of meat. I was experimenting with this. I was actually experimenting for years to figure out the process of koshering of meat and everything. And I'll say something very simple, just as a reminder. The thing is that you can never really remove all the blood from meat. It's never it's not doable.
Mm.
But what you can do is remove a high percentage of it. So, for example, Maimonides comes from a perspective that you have to really try to remove every little drop of blood inside the meat.
Possible.
And he has this method, he describes it, and my wife and I experimented with this method dozens of times, and it just doesn't work. It does not happen. We tried with tap water, cold water, warmish water, hot water. We tried with so many things, different combinations, variations. It doesn't work. You can never remove all the blood from meat. And this is why I actually turned over to a Karaite friend of mine, not Nehemiah actually, another Karaite friend of mine. And I asked him, you know, how do you deal with these verses? You know, don't eat blood and everything. And all he had to do was to cut and paste them and put them in sequence in front of me. And I went, oh, okay, now I get it. And he actually noticed that really what the Torah is forbidden, this is in Deuteronomy 12, is the actual blood that's poured when you slaughter the animal. And whatever is inside the flesh, the organs, and whatever it would be, is actually not forbidden. Now, obviously, when you want to deal with meat, you wash it off. You wash it. You put. It's a very good idea to salt your meat in general because it cleans it from bacteria. Mm-hmm. In the ancient world, this was one of the ways of protecting your meat as well from spoilage. And you salt the meat, it removes all the bacteria, it removes a little bit of the blood, it doesn't remove everything. Mm-hmm. So people started asking me questions like, can you eat a rare steak or a steak? And the answer is yes.
Mm.
Now, if you're worried about blood and everything, then don't eat meat, seriously, because if you want to prevent yourself from eating any form of blood,
that's right.
You cannot touch meat
at concern,
all.
Yeah, if it's that much of a concern to you, hey, vegetarian, that's all right, you can do it.
Yeah, I mean, chicken is easier to clean. Chicken doesn't have that much blood. I mean, I've been in slaughterhouses. I've checked how much blood comes out of chickens, out of goats, out of cows.
Mm.
When you slaughter a cow, you really, really have to take your distance because it sprays everywhere.
Ew. Thanks for that.
It's pretty nasty.
But you want to make sure that you slaughter properly so that they bleed properly. And really,
that's
about the extent of it. You hang them when you dress them. And, well, let's not go into the great detail, but if we could, because yeah, we could.
I'll say one thing. The whole issue of consumption of blood, you have to understand what's done. In some slaughterhouses, they have this special storage structure underneath the slaughter area that collects the blood. And when it collects the blood, they actually take it and use it for food industry.
You.
And for the food industry. And basically what happens is that it goes into different forms of food, and this is really what Torah is talking about.
Mm, yeah, and you don't want that. But in this passage that we're about to read, suet. What is suet? Actually, I tell you what, before we get there,
let's actually start reading first of all.
Let me start reading, and when I get to it, you can remind everyone. Okay, so this is from verse 12 is where we're picking up. It says, now the sons of Eli were corrupt. What does it say? Come on, Yoel. What does it say?
So again, we have this concept of Nevelial.
Once again,
we've dealt with this one over and over and over again. It's actually a word that shows up a lot here, and then it vanishes at one point. We don't really see it that much, as far as I remember. But it's interesting what it does here, because it actually defines what it means that the Bnei Belial, that their Bnei Belial lo yadu et Adonai, they actually don't know the Lord, they don't know God. That's what it defines here. So this is what we can call this a type of parallel. Maybe what's called a synonymous parallel, which means the second half is similar to the first half, and sometimes elaborates on what's mentioned in the first half, explaining what it means. So Ben Belial in the context of the Bible probably means a person who has no God. And this works actually, if we break down the word differently, it's Bli'al.
Mm-hmm.
Al is a preposition, means above or high above something. So they were without the one above, basically without God. So there's sometimes parallels enable us to explain obscure words and obscure terms in the Bible.
And the priest's custom with the people was that when any man offered a sacrifice, the priest's servant, I've got servant here, would come.
Yeah, not a Kohen, it's a priest's servant. So it's interesting, they actually had people working there. And it's a question if these were Levites, because it says that the Levites' job was to help in the temple. And this is a temple of sorts. And the question is this actually, are these actually Levites? Or are they just men that worked in the temple as help, which raises question, what exactly was the work of the Levites? Because we have to remember that the Levites in the desert carried the tabernacle. When they entered the land, they went to their cities, which raises questions. Did the were the Levites really supposed to be in the temple directly? Or were they scattered amongst the nation, inside the nation, to be the ones who bear the Torah inside the different tribal groups?
That's a really good point. That's a really good point because it doesn't specify, but it makes mentions of the priest's servant and says they would come with a three-pronged fork. Ah, now here we are. I've got, I don't have fork. Yeah, well, I've got three-pronged flesh hook in his hand.
So we have the word mazleg. Now, in modern Hebrew, the word mazleg. In modern Hebrew, the word mazleg means a fork. Okay. Now, I don't necessarily say that it's the same meaning as what we have today in modern Hebrew, but it could be that someone once told me it might have been just a long stick with like three hooks on it. They enable them to go in and pull it out. But there's also the possibility, I mean, I was looking through dictionaries and the possibility was that it's actually like a fork. It was literally like a fork. And the reason I mentioned the whole thing and that we invented the fork before the Europeans is because up to the medieval times, people either ate with their hands or the spoon. And in the East, they ate with chopsticks. And then someone came up with this brilliant idea. So they had a spoon and they had a knife of sorts. So they were able to grab the piece of meat and cut it with their hand and the knife. And someone had a brilliant idea, I can't remember who it was, but basically said, well, we want to put down the piece of meat or whatever it is and cut it. And they came up with this idea of a fork.
Brilliant. Been using one ever since.
And I actually come from an English family, which means I was taught how to properly use a fork. I can actually sit down and dismember any piece of food with a knife and fork and not even touch anything on the plate.
You are truly a talented man. But anyway.
It took my mother a very long time to teach me that.
So they'd plunge the fork into the meat, the boiling whatever it is, a pan or a kettle or a cauldron or a pot. The priest
It's not a pan. These sound more like deep vessels.
Okay.
And it's interesting they're not doing a barbecue. I'm kind of surprised, but it uses the word kiyol, which is the same word that we have for the lever inside the tabernacle. So this is some kind of a copper, maybe a copper, though I doubt if it's copper because usually cooked with clay. One of the things that they do in archaeology is that they're able to define the time of the layer based on clay, and they actually had these cooking clay vessels. These might be different sizes, small ones, big ones, tall ones, shallow ones, and this is probably what we're seeing here.
Sure. But in any case, they'd plunge it in, and whatever came out, that's what they would have. And so they did in Shiloh to all the Israelites who came there. Also, before they burned the fat, I've got the priest's servants would come and say to the man who sacrificed, give us meat for roasting to the priest or he will not take boiled meat from you, but raw. And if the man is making the sacrifice, if the man says to him, I should really burn the fat first, and then you can take as much as your heart desires, well, he would say, the servant would say to him, no, but you must give it to me now, and if not, I will take it by force.
This is a very, very interesting thing. First of all, it gives us, if you actually read in between the lines, it gives us a few details regarding how it was actually done. What it looks like is that people bought their sacrifices. Mm-hmm. I have to remember, this is a relatively small temple. When I actually get around to putting the video up of the area that they think the tabernacle was at, it's actually a very, very small temple, which means there's a lot of work has to be done there. But it looks like as if they slaughtered the animal, the priest would take the blood, sprinkle it around the altar, and the owner would they would remove the fats, and then the owner would take the meat with him and cut it up. which means half the work was done by the priest, half the work was done by the Levite. The owner.
Yeah.
The owner of the sacrifice. And they reach a point, they start piling up the fat and doing it as fast as they can, mm-hmm. which means you can imagine like bowls or tables with pieces of fat in them, maybe organized like, you know, they know which order things are in, so they know each sacrifice what it is. Mm-hmm. And there's this whole discussion of intention. They have to have an intention in their mind that this is this specific sacrifice or that specific sacrifice. There's a whole discussion in Talmud about that. But we put that one aside. You see that people were a lot more involved in the temple service. This was a national temple. This wasn't like in the Second Temple period when they kept everyone away. No, don't get anywhere near. That was a very Sadducee thing. They were always worried about, you're going to contaminate the temple, keep away, stay away. Here, no, people are involved. Hanak comes near the temple. They're in it. They're involved. Hanak's in the temple. The owner of the sacrifice is nearby.
Mm-hmm.
And now Halevi the Fourth is requesting my attention for a second.
Hey, Halevi the Fourth. Why can't we hear him? Okay. We did hear him last week.
I was keeping him. He's sitting in his high chair, and now I'm letting him out.
Ah, he's okay. Free. He's free to roam.
Born free.
Prince Halevi the Fourth. So now just remind everyone, though, this is what they've got. So they make the sacrifice, but I've got fat. Okay, I burn the fat. But this, going back to the blood, you know, people say, do you have to remove all the blood? The same question is, you know, do I have to trim the fat around the steak and all of this sort of stuff? What is the word that is used in the Hebrew?
So the word used here is chelev. Now, chelev does not necessarily chelev. Mm-hmm. Chet, lamed, bet. Do not confuse it with chalav, which is chalav, milk.
Milk.
And I actually met this guy years ago. This was like 12 or 13 years ago. I met this man who refused to drink milk. And I sat down, he sat down with me and started talking. He said, do you know Hebrew? And we're having a discussion. He says, I wanted to convert. And I'm like, okay, cool. And mm-hmm. he says, but they wouldn't convert because I refused to drink milk.
Okay.
And I said to him, is there a chance that you're confusing chalav with chelev, the fat or the forbidden? It's actually not necessarily just fat. Because if we go back to Leviticus 4, we actually have a definition there of everything that's called chelev. Some of them are fat, some of them are not. So we're not talking about fat. We're talking about prime parts. Chelev basically means the prime whatever it would be.
Mm-hmm.
If it's a prime cut, if it's a prime piece of fruit, if it's a prime of whatever it would be. So chelev should be translated as not as fat, but as the prime organ.
Beautiful. So what is the difference between suet and chelev?
So suet is actually it's mostly certain fats that go around the area of the stomach. So it's not even enough to define it like that. So as I said, it's really the prime part. So we have two fats in the stomach area. One overlays the entire intestinal area, and then the entire digestive system, and then one specifically on the area of the actual stomach.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have the liver. There's a piece off the liver. Mm-hmm. We have the fat on the kidneys and the kidneys themselves. And in sheep, we actually have a tail. There's a big piece of fatty fat on the tail itself. Mm. And those really are the five, depending. If it's goats and ox, that's five, not including the tail. I keep on getting this question of, can we eat oxtail? The answer is yes, you can eat oxtail. The tail fat that's forbidden is only from sheep.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so what they're saying here is that they used to take these pieces off, put them up together in a small pile, maybe in a ball, mm-hmm. and they'll throw it on the altar and burn it. Now, you were mentioning this whole thing from the Jewish Bible. It says that would be smoked or something. What was it?
Yeah, suet. It says in verse, and this is in the Jewish Study Bible. In verse 15, it says, "But now, even before the suet was turned into smoke, the priest's boy would come and say to the man who was sacrificing, hand over some of the meat to roast, and so on and so forth."
So turn into smoke is too literal. It's not a really good translation. What it basically means, the root lehaktir katar, so it doesn't mean to turn to smoke. It means to actually offer it on a fire. And it does turn it into smoke, but the verb itself doesn't mean to turn to smoke.
Interesting.
I mean, you might say that, on a certain level of analogy, yes, it means to turn into smoke, but it's not, the verb itself is actually a verb that has to do with sacrificing and putting on a fire, mm-hmm. allowing smoke to come up. So it's more just turning from smoke. It's the process of actually doing the sacrifice. It's interesting that it uses the root yiktirun. First of all, the un at the end is an elongated future, which indicates a very old type of Hebrew. But also, they're using the root of katar is very interesting as well, because we have the ktorit, which is the incense, and that's actually burning on fire. So it's very interesting. It's using specifically this verb. I mean, I won't be surprised if we go back to Leviticus, we'll probably find this verb as well. Yeah, it uses this verb as well. I mean, if you go back into Leviticus, I just opened up randomly chapter 7, it uses in chapter 7, verse 5, Yiktil otam akoyin ha-mizbecha. So it's actually imitating the same terminology used in Leviticus.
Okay. So it says the priest shall burn them on the altar as an offering made by fire to Yehovah. It is a trespass offering.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. So now listen. So verse 17, it says, therefore the sin of the young men was very great before Yehovah, for men abhorred the offering of Yehovah. And so clearly the servants that we're talking about here is the young men, the sons of Eli. That's fair?
So the young men here, so first of all, the word na'ar. I actually had an incident several years ago when someone called me a young boy or young man. I actually told them it's actually kind of insulting in our culture, because the thing is that when you call someone a na'ar, you're not just calling them a young man or a young boy, you're actually calling them stupid, or you're saying that they're of a low class of intelligence.
Oh, you're referring to them as immature.
So here he's calling them ne'arim, either because he's not, because they're not, you know, na'ar ha-kohen. Mm-hmm. We had na'ar already as a servant of the kohen, but here he's using the word na'ar with association what we mentioned earlier to say they're behaving like, you know, stupid young men who don't really know what they're doing and they're misbehaving. He's basically being nasty towards them, and he's right about it. I mean, this is what they're doing. And it goes on. I mean, it's interesting. It's also, the description is very, very long. Usually the Bible, if it tries to emphasize something, you'll give a longer description to emphasize how bad the situation is.
And so it's illustrating that they have no, they don't care. They don't care about the proper protocol of what is meant to happen with the sacrifice. They just want, you know, the best parts now. They want to give me the raw meat. I'm going to take it to the barbecue. I don't want it boiled. This is what they're doing. They're going outside of protocol. And therefore, according to verse 17, they abhorred the offering of Yehovah. And that's the introduction that we have of Eli's sons from verse 12 to verse 17. But on the flip side of the coin, Yoel.
Exactly. We have now the contrast. Now, Samuel, this is what's going on. Now that, as I mentioned last time, this is the issue of the fall of the house of Eli and the rise of Samuel and his leadership. Mm. And there's the contrast is very, very strong here. In these Indeed. Verses, this contrast is emphasized to the nth degree, basically.
And you really notice it in the coming chapters, because it does go back and forth with these guys. It says, but, it begins with but Samuel ministered before Yehovah, even as a child, wearing a linen ephod. Moreover, his mother, there you go, his mum.
So by the way, he's also mentioned as a na'ar here, but as a contrast to what was mentioned earlier. So he's also a servant. He's also in the temple, probably functioning mostly as a servant and not necessarily as a priest or a Levite or something. But it's using the word na'ar again to emphasize the difference in between him and the sons of Eli, who are mentioned as ne'arim as well in the previous verse. You have to pay attention to these little details. And this is what gets lost inside translation. You kind of lose some of the ideas projected by the words, the type of words which are picked to describe things. You lose a lot when you read a translation.
And it says, verse 19, moreover, his mother used to make him a little robe and bring it to him year by year when she came up with her husband to offer the yearly sacrifices.
Your translation says robe?
I got a robe. What do you got?
So it uses the word me'il, which is probably etymologically from the word me'al, which means an above piece of clothing. So it wasn't a robe. It wasn't his main piece of clothing. It's an overcoat of sorts.
Oh, okay.
And this overcoat, actually, by the way, is one of the signs of who he is. It shows up a couple of times.
It does. It shows up in the transfer of commission to Elisha. Yeah, is it the same word?
No, in Elijah, it's aderet, which is a heavy overcoat of sorts. It's something. An aderet is usually made of hair, and it's a big, heavy thing. And
so it's a completely different.
It's a different piece of garment. It shows up two more times at least. One place where it tears when Saul grabs hold of it, and then he says, "The Lord has torn the kingdom off of you." And then it shows up again when Saul brings him up from the dead.
He's got,
and that's
like
how they identify it.
Overcoat on. What's going on there? We got spirit clothes in Sheol.
No, it's an imagery.
Oh, come on.
So they identify who it is.
We've got a whole spirit wardrobe. What are you saying?
A whole spirit wardrobe. Okay.
But it is. It's in the vision anyhow. The witch of Endor brings him up out of the ground. So that's really quite peculiar as well.
She's not a witch. It says Baalat Ov. Baalat Ov is not a witch. A Mechashefa is a witch.
She's
It's a medium. She's a medium.
True. Anyway, so his mother. So she loves him. She sees him at least once a year and she makes him little clothes. He's such a cute little fella. And brings it to him year by year. And then and Eli would bless Elkanah, his father, and his wife, and say, Yehovah give you descendants from this woman for the loan I've got. And we commented on this last week, for the loan that was given to Yehovah. And then they would go and go to their own home. And Yehovah visited Hannah so that she conceived and bore three sons and two daughters. And meanwhile, the child Shmuel, Samuel, grew before the Lord.
So it's interesting. He says visited. It's the use of the word pakad, and we have the same word pakad also with Sarah. So it's not visit. It's to, for example, pakod efkod asui lachem b'mitzrayim. It's not an issue of visiting. It's an issue of turning and paying attention to focus your attention towards something and dealing with it. And it appears in several places.
Is that the same word where, like, in my translation, every now and then, Yehovah will remember whoever it is and act on their behalf. Is that the same word?
So we actually have the word pkida as for example, I think with Samson we had it as well. It says, v'yifkor et ishto b'gidi izim. Let's look at that one for a second.
Actually, you know what?
So it's an issue.
I think it even appears in regards to Hannah. You keep talking. I'm just going to find it.
No, so basically the word pakad is to visit, but it's not just to visit. It's to pay attention, to be involved in something, to act upon something. It says, v'yamim b'yamei kitzir chitim v'yifkod shimshon et ishto. He actually went to visit her, and it's a visitation with a purpose. So again, the dynamics of verbs in the Bible is pretty wide.
The question that I have is verse 19 of chapter 1 of Samuel. First Samuel
verse
1.
Verse 19 of chapter 1.
Verse 19. So
verse
it says,
19.
They went home and Elkanah, his wife, and Yehovah remembered her. It's a different word, right?
Yeah, it's the root zachar. So yifkod or pakad is pei kuf daled, while zachar is zayin chafresh. Not to confuse zachar with zachar. There's two interesting story. I'll bring it up when we reach the story of Amalek. I'll tell a little story about that. Okay. But not to confuse zachar with memory or to remember with zecher or zachar to zachar with male. There's a little story, a Talmudic midrashic story about this, the confusion of zachar and zecher, and I'll bring up when we get to the Amalek story.
Okay. Well, in a nutshell, again, how does to remember and visit, how are they different in definition in the Hebrew?
No, so to visit, to remember is to remember, mentally remember. Mm-hmm. And not necessarily act upon it, but pakad usually involves an action of sorts. Usually, I mean, again, it's an issue of pulling out this word from different locations and looking how it's used. Mm-hmm. As I just said, the dynamics of verbs, the dynamics of words in general in the Bible. If you remember, Hebrew has less words, for example, than English. Mm-hmm. So words are used in different associations, and each time you want to interpret a word, you don't just look at it, just open up your BDB or whatever dictionary you're using and say, and decide. And you have to look at context. You have to look at the different context, because a word can be used in different meanings in different locations. And here specifically, pakad is not necessarily to visit. I mean, you have, for example, with Samson, it says, v'yifkod et ishto b'gidizim. He went and he visited her, mm-hmm. but lifkod also has some action meaning. He's doing something. So here, God pakadota, which means he remembered her, he acted upon this memory, and basically caused her to have children.
Yeah. And so in 119, God remembers her, and she conceived Samuel. But in chapter 2, verse 21, he visits Hannah, and it says, she bore three children, two daughters, and meanwhile, Samuel grew before the Lord. Now, Yoel, Eli was very old. He was old.
Very old. He was 98 years old.
Hey, that's not bad. That's pretty good innings. And he, he heard everything his sons did to all Israel, and how they, and get this, how they lay with the women.
Okay, so there's a bit of a debate exactly what it means that they laid with the women.
It says they laid with the women who assembled at the door of the tabernacle of meeting.
So some people say that it's literal. They actually were doing things they weren't supposed to be doing. Mm-hmm. But there is an opinion that says that it wouldn't make sense. I mean, why would, you know, if you go to the temple and someone's, say, you know, a woman comes over with whatever sacrifice she has, and this guy says, well, if you want to get in, you have to do something here. There are a lot of people who raise eyebrows about this, and they're saying that it's not that. It's actually an act of immodest behavior that they have to sit out, you know, the women have to camp outside of the temple. And so it's not that they're not doing something forbidden, you know, but they're actually, what they're causing them is to wait. So they take their time. Now, usually women, most of the time, we're talking about bird sacrifices.
Mm-hmm.
Bird sacrifices, there's nothing they get from them. The priest, you know, because what do I mean bird sacrifices? A woman who gives birth, or a woman who had some kind of blood flow, has mm-hmm. to bring a sacrifice. Now, these sacrifices are usually pigeons.
Yep.
They don't get anything from the pigeons, so it's not worthwhile, you know, for them to even deal with it. Mm-hmm. So they take their time. If there's a lot of people out there with good beef and cattle and stuff, they'll let them in first. And these women have to wait and wait and wait. And then the service ends at sunset. And now they have to wait for the next day. So that might be the reason, this might be what they're actually talking about. Yeah, the sacrifices were not worthwhile, and it works together with what's mentioned earlier.
And still a very, very serious sin, obviously, too.
Dealing with the temple on the financial benefit level, which is the main accusation here. So why, after we already mentioned the accusation, why do we now mention this side issue of, that's a big thing as well. I mean, that's serious if we take this literally. So I have to say that it's probably not literal. It probably means that it was tied up together with the financial benefits of being a priest.
Sure, very good point. 23, so he said to them, why do you do such things? Eli says to his sons, for I hear of your evil dealings from all the people. No, my sons, for it is not a good report that I hear. You make Yehovah's people transgress, and one man sins against another, and God will judge him. But if a man sins against the Lord, who will intercede for him? Nevertheless, Yoel, they did not heed to the voice of their father, because Yehovah desired to kill them. That's what I've got.
This is interesting theological discussion or philosophical discussion at this point. We have a similar thing twice at least in with Pharaoh.
Mm-hmm.
And we have it with the king of Moab, with Sihon, yes, the king of Heshbon,
yes,
that God blocks the ability to listen and understand so this person will receive a punishment. And we actually also have this in Isaiah. He says, Hashmen lev ha'am hazeh ve'oznav hashah, make the heart of this nation fat and their ears blocked. And there's this element where God basically says, listen, you had a chance. You weren't listening.
Yep.
I told you several times. You know what? I'm fed up.
You had a chance. You blew it. I'm going to make an example of you guys.
So I remember when I was in high school, we were learning Jewish philosophy. I actually majored in Jewish philosophy and Bible studies.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a discussion about this, and it was entwined in one another, Jewish philosophy and the Bible, because the Book of Job and other things that appear in different mm-hmm. places in the Bible. And I remember this was a main issue that we were discussing about, the issue of free will, and we had over a month of classes just on this subject. And the Jewish philosophers basically, I think it's almost everyone agreed on this, that there is this type of punishment that God disables the ability to repent. Your free will is completely taken away from you.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it's kind of a shocking idea, but we have this a couple of times appearing in the Bible, and we have it here as well. So it's a it's a pretty bold statement what's going on here.
Where it says that God hardened their hearts.
Exactly. They weren't able to listen. There's also an interesting thing. The father here is very soft with them. Mm-hmm. He's not putting his foot down. First, remember, emphasized, he's old. Mm-hmm. He's turned around to his sons. His words here, if you read in Hebrew, are slightly muffled. It's like either kind of confused, not too clear. I mean, it's clear what he's trying to say, but he's jumping from one type of style of speech to another. There's opinions that say that because he was old and he just had difficulty saying it, and a 98-year-old man walks up to his son holding his stick going like, oh, what are you doing? You know? And some people say that the reason we have all these different sentences because this was in different occasions. But part of the criticism here about Eli is that he wasn't hot enough on his sons. He wasn't using harsh enough language. And you know, if he's responsible to the temple, he has to kick them off the force and basically say, "Go home, get out of here, scram."
And so it's a reflection on him as a father and his ability to be assertive and his ability to enforce that which he mm-hmm. rules. Even though he says to them, "Oh, you're doing the wrong things," but he doesn't actually. It would appear he doesn't step in and actually take action against them. I mean, at the very extreme end of the scale, I suppose, Yoel, we would be talking about Deuteronomy 21 in regards to the rebellious son. But there is not even there seems to be no action taken against them, just words, and they just continue on.
So a rebellious son, we usually explain that a rebellious son is someone who still lives in his parents' house. Mm-hmm. Here, I mean, they're already adults. I mean, if he's 98 years old, they're probably somewhere in their 60s.
Yeah, that's a good point.
They might even be somewhere in their 70s.
Mm.
And so they're not children anymore. So the law of the disobedient son is not at any age. I mean, for example, you see the description there. Ben Uze Ochel Vesove Zolel Zolel. This son of ours is eating and drinking and fanning himself, but he's not listening to us. Then it sounds as if more he's in his parents' house. He's not. Mm. He's still at home.
Mm.
You know, he's a 30-year-old guy living with his mother, whatever it would be. You know?
Sure. But considering the punishment that is involved in Deuteronomy there, something of a serious nature has to be applied to these guys, and yet we don't see Eli enforcing anything but words.
Exactly. It's all words, and he's not doing anything to stop them. You know, he's the head of the nation. He is the person that everyone turns around for as an example, for advice. You know,
he's the man in the tabernacle.
He's the man in the tabernacle. He is the most important character in the Israelite world, and this is what he does. This is why this action is so severe. Leadership. If you're a leader, you really really, really, really have to watch yourself. There's actually a saying in the Talmud that says that a man is responsible for his family. A head of a city is responsible for his city. It's a father's responsible for his household. A head of a family is responsible for the entire family. And goes on and on until it reaches, and the head of the nation is responsible for the entire nation. This is why, for example, there's an atonement, a special atonement sacrifice for the high priest. And it says, "Ki yecheta l'ashmat ha'am." If he sins for the guilt of the nation, if he makes a mistake, it's not just on him; it's on the entire nation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This is why it's so severe. This is he has sinful sons. It's not just that; it's the fact that if he does something, everyone looks at it and they take his example. Either they take his example, or it can be even worse than that. Like we have here, they actually start saying, "What's the point of going to the temple? What's the point of doing all of this? These people are corrupt. These religious leaders are corrupt." And really, when you want to become a religious leader, you really, really, really have to be careful. It's not just I have knowledge, I have power, therefore I'm going to become the leader. No, 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 no. And this is what we learned from the story of David. We'll see you later on. God picks very, very specific people.
But actually, it takes me back, Yoel, and maybe you can tell me where this is. I'm just trying to find it now. But it reminds me of the verse where God says, "I chose Abraham, for I know that he will command his children after him."
The choosing of Abraham. I mean, now we're actually, we just read Genesis and Noah, and now we're about to go to Lech Lecha. Mm. And that part of the story there is the process of choosing who would be the right person to carry the message of God in the world. Mm. It's a choosing. And being, for example, being a descendant of Israel, you know, it's why is there so much criticism about Jews? Why is there so much criticism about Israel? Because we're a beacon in the world. We're Israel, and the people who follow the God of Israel are the beacon in the world, are the leadership, quote unquote. And when you make a mistake, God makes sure you know you did something wrong. Mm. So the criticism against Israel, I mean, I personally think it's reversed. I mean, the criticism on Israel is the fact that we're not putting our foot down and saying, okay, we're going to rebuild the temple. We're going to establish Torah in the land. This is why we're going through all everything that's been going on the past 30 years, 40 years, 50 years, 60 years, 100 years. It's because we were supposed to do something and we're not doing it. And God keeps on throwing these messages at us, but our leadership in Israel is misinterpreting this as being, well, we have to be afraid of the nations. No, we have to put our foot down and show them who's in charge, do the Torah, completely ignore everyone else, and everything is going to get settled. Everything is going to fall into place. But instead of that, everyone's like sitting there, you know, political analysis going like, analysts going like, oh, well, we really have to bow down to everything the UN says, and we have to bow down to everything the European Union says, because really they know the truth, and they know the ones who really know what's supposed to happen, and la la la. And it's not even that. This is completely missing the point.
Sorry, I was just going to say it's Genesis, Bereshit 18, verse 19, I think. For I have known him in order that he may command his children and his household after him, that they may keep the way of Yehovah to do righteousness and justice, that Yehovah may bring Abraham what he has spoken to him. So, I mean,
so we actually have something similar to this later on. We're going to see in a moment where the prophet goes to him, says, "I chose you from your father's house." So it's the same thing here. Abraham was chosen from his father's house, who was chosen from that father's house, basically from different descendants of the world, from Shem, Ham, and Yefet, basically. And Abraham was chosen for his qualities. It's not just, you know, with Abraham, it was really hard work. He had to kind of like prove himself. He wasn't really trying to prove himself. Basically, he, like Noah, he showed signs of being a righteous man, a person who's fitting for the leadership of the people who represent God in the world. And God said, okay, that's my man. And he goes to him and says to him, okay, I've chosen you. Now teach your children this message.
Amen.
And this is why there's a criticism. If it says, "V'higata levincha v'yomo le'emon," you tell your son on that day, and then it gives a quotation, it's the responsibility of a father to pass down this information to his children. Now, if you're the high priest, as we say in Hebrew, oy vavoy lecha, you should watch yourself if you make a mistake. Be very careful.
There's a lot that's expected from you. But in any case, they did not heed the voice of their father. And so it says, because of that, Yehovah decided to kill them. And on the flip side of the coin, once again, verse 26, and the child Samuel grew in stature and in favor, both with Yehovah and men. And then a man of God. Now, I think you referred to him as a prophet.
There's so much issues here, so many issues. I mean, I really, really have to do this. I'm sorry. I'm taking over. no, I'm kidding. No, it's interesting because it uses holech, vegadel, vetov. It's using like these three verbs one after the other. He's not only physically growing, he's mentally growing. He's grown inside the nation, and we see the contrast. The house of Eli's reducing in size and becoming smaller and smaller and worse and wicked in the eyes of the nation. And Samuel, on the other hand, is growing better, good in the eyes of the people, and it's just a contrast. You really have to pay attention to these things, because I can't read this and not notice this stuff. So
no, but it is. It's like when you're reading about it, you're quite right, because when you're reading about Eli and his sons, it's like doom and gloom and clouds and rain, and then you read, and then there's the next verse, and Samuel, and it's like sunshine and butterflies and flowers and happiness.
The light at the end of the darkness of the tunnel, the previous book we read.
That's it. That's the one. But then, a man of God. Now, a man of God. So is he a messenger? Is he a prophet? What is he? Or is he just a man of God? A man of God came to Eli.
So obviously he's a prophet. I mean, he doesn't use the word prophet yet here. When we go into chapter 3, which I doubt if we will do today, we might not be able to fit it in. But anyhow, Ish Elohim, I mean, again, we had something similar to this. I mean, if we go back to Manoach, the father of Samson, I mean, I think, and his mother, specifically his mother, where is it? It says, it says here in verse 6, that Ish Elohim, Ish Ha-Elohim, the man of God, came to her. So again, this can be an angel. like we had with Samson. This can be a prophet. Now, what's interesting, there's no name. He's not mentioned, but we have, on the other hand, I think if we go into the Book of Kings, we have Ahav.
Yeah, that's right.
So no Ahav, we have Jeroboam, which I, by the way, mention and talk about him in the Time Will Tell video series that Keith Johnson is producing. There, I did it. I put the ad in.
Hey, wait, give him the website as well. Timewilltell.tv is the website.
Yes, and I actually got to watch the first video. Fortunately, I wasn't in that video, man. Why? No, I'm kidding.
It's a great video. But my kids watched it, and they said it's funny. This guy's funny, and then they said, "Where's the rest of it?"
And so there's several parts to it. There's several parts you have to wait for it to come out.
It's really good, yeah, so, people. If you haven't got it, you need to get it. Particularly if you've got the kids are going to love to watch it as well. And the website is timewilltell.tv.
From my personal experience, Keith and also Nehemiah, they both come. They've been in my house many times, and they're very good with children. I mean, really, I was pleasantly surprised with Nehemiah and Keith, both the interaction with my children, everything. And Keith's point is, you know, he's fun. I really enjoyed working with him. It was really, really lots of fun to work with him. It was funny. We run around. We go up here. Oh, I want to go up there. And I'm running around chasing him down half the time because he's like, oh, let's go see what's over there. It was loads of fun. He really edited the video very, very well. And really what he needs now is support to enable to produce these videos. I mean, we traveled. He and I traveled in areas that I don't think he would have been able to go there if I wasn't with him. And he went around lots of places in Israel. And really, you know, the point is to spread the word of the idea of this video, which is a very, very important message. People are still celebrating feasts based on obscure things the churches are taking, feasts and interpreting them in their own world. And Keith basically says, well, let's figure out the real clock of God. And, you know, I'm actually very happy I was involved in it. It was fun. And the video itself is loads of fun. And
it's brilliant.
So if you can support Keith, if you can go into Time to Tell and become a sponsor of Souls, that will really help promote this, because it's a lot of work. It's a lot of editing work. I mean, we filmed, he and I filmed a lot of this in March. I mean, 7 months ago, there was a wonderful family that came with him and helped him film. I was with him part of the time, and he went around by himself as well a lot, and it was a long walk. And seven months later, that's when the video actually came out. So it's a lot of work and it's a lot of money. So if you can,
it's
help
an incredible
him,
amount of work, nice. And it's a very worthy project to support. Timewilltell.tv. Jeroboam, that's where we were going with the.
So
the
we're
man
going
of
to
God.
Jeroboam, chapter 13. So the thing is that Keith and I went to Bet El, into the area of Bet El, and we're filming there. And so this is why I'm bringing it up. I'm actually mentioning him because he changes the calendar. He makes up this feast on the 8th month instead of the 7th month. It's a feast like in Jerusalem. He tries to change the calendar. But he mentions here in chapter 13, First Kings chapter 13, verse 1, it says, Behold, there is a man of God, Ish Elohim, Bami Yehuda. So here it's obviously a human being because he's come from Judah. So here it's not 100% clear to me if this is actually an angel or if it's a prophet of sorts, because prophecy was very, very rare at the time. We have that in chapter 3 mentions the word of God was very scarce at the time.
Yes.
So this man of God, whatever he was.
Whatever he was, came to Eli and said to him, "Thus says Jehovah, did I not clearly reveal myself to the house of your father?" And I guess he's speaking of Aaron. When they were in in Egypt, in Pharaoh's house, did I not choose him out of all the tribes of Israel to be my priest, to offer up upon my altar, to burn incense and to wear an ephod before me? And did I not give to the house of your father all the offerings of the children of Israel made by fire? Why do you kick at my sacrifice and my offering, which I have commanded in my dwelling place, and honor your sons more than me, to make yourselves fat with the best of all the offerings of the people of Israel? Israel, my people. Therefore, Jehovah, God of Israel, says, I said indeed that your house and the house of your father would walk before me forever. But now, Jehovah says, far be it from me, for those who honor me I will honor, but those who despise me shall be lightly esteemed. Is that what you've got in the Hebrew, lightly esteemed?
So the word is yikalu. And the root is kalal, which is from the word of klala as well, a curse. So it's interesting. There's usually we translate the root, so ikalohi will become light. Yes, it's true. But it goes into another thing. So the root, the word the kalel, to curse someone. For example, it mentions, I think, in Exodus 21, I think, a person who curses his parents, or a person that curses an Elohim, which usually means a judge. Mm-hmm. So it's not necessarily to curse, it's also to behave in a light-minded way towards that person. So it doesn't mean that a son turns around to his father and says something really nasty or some cuss word. Also means a general way of behavior. Don't behave in a light-headed way towards your elders, towards people above you. So it's not just cursing, it's also this. So we learned this actually from looking at this word, because yikalu, so really from the root of kal. Okay, but if it was kal, it would appear differently. So I think ikalu is also from the root of kalal, which is kuf lamed lamed, which means light-headedness or light behavior towards someone. And it's also very important to notice that it's very intense what he's saying here. First, it's very long.
It gets really serious right here, Yoel, in verse 31. Behold, the days are coming that I will cut off your arm and the arm of your father's house, so that there will not be an old man in your house, and you will see an enemy in my dwelling place, despite all the good which God does for Israel. And there shall not be an old man in your house forever. It's got forever.
Wow.
How about that?
By the way, you said an enemy in the house. So the term here is tzar ma'on, and there's a lot of different opinions what tzar ma'on actually means. It might be that they'll, you know, if we actually look into continuing the stories, really there was a rivalry in between, when David dies, David basically says to Tzadok, to Zadok, now you're going to be the high priest. So Eviatar turns when Adoniyahu rebels against Solomon, or actually rebels against David, essentially, or it's kind of like in between. He's rebelling against Solomon, but he's really rebelling against David. Eviatar, who's the descendants of the house of Eli, of Eli, joins him. So he actually kind of works this interpretation. I never thought of this interpretation being a serious one. An enemy in the dwelling, and it works, that he basically says that there'll be a rivalry, and actually that works with the story of Yatal and Tzadok. So that's actually probably a very good translation.
Hey, there's a point for the New King James. Because I'm just looking at my Jewish Bible as well, and it has a totally different take on it, Yoel. It says in verse 32, it says, you will gaze grudgingly.
Yeah, that's the classic one. That was when I was taught in high school as well, that Tzal Ma'on is grudging, gaze grudgingly. It's strange. It's a strange term. I mean, maybe if I sit down and do a research about fossilized terms in other ancient Near Eastern texts, I might find something similar to it, and then it might interpret it. But you never know. This might be some kind of a term that lost its meaning throughout time, but it was fossilized here.
Yeah, perhaps. So, in any case, I've got an enemy in my dwelling place. It goes on to say, but any of your men whom I do not cut off from my altar shall consume your eyes and grieve your heart, and all the descendants of your house shall die. Now, get this. This is what I've got in English. Shall die in the flower of their age. Is that what you've
got?
It
says, Yamutu Anashim. They'll die a young age. And there's actually an interesting Talmudic story that mentions a city that had a whole bunch of people there who died. They called them the black-headed, shchorei rosh, they mean young people, and they all kept on dying at a very, very young age. And when they did a genealogy check on them, they discovered that they were descendants of the house of Eli, which means...
Oh, really?
Then they told them, how do you avoid dying very young? You just should start practicing righteousness and study Torah, and hopefully that will help you. So at least on this verse, there's a midrash that talks about this, and so that might be the correct interpretation of this verse, that they die.
Because listen,
young.
That'd be a really concerning thing, right? Because this is what it says, and it seems to be in such concrete terms. Like in verse 32, where it says forever, and it says forever a number of times, if I remember correctly. I'll just keep reading. It says now here's the sign. This shall be the sign to you, verse 34, that will come upon your two sons, on Hophni and Pinchas. In one day they shall die, both of them. Then I will raise up for myself a faithful priest who shall do according to what is in my heart and in my mind. I will build him a sure house, and he will walk before me. my anointed forever. There's another forever, and ooh, it shall come to pass.
Wait.
What do you got?
Read that one, that last section again, that verse.
I will build him for a sure house, and he will walk before my anointed forever.
Okay, so it should be my anointed one. That he's already hinting the concept of a king. But this doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm. There is, really? Okay, so it should be my anointed one.
He will walk before my anointed one, I mean, together with him. And that's the whole thing. There's really the leadership of Israel is divided up into the king and the high priest. And we see that, for example, in the book of Haggai, we see that when they return to the land of Israel, the character of the high priest is kind of pushed aside at one point in the book of Kings, and the high priest, there we find the genealogy of the names and everything, but they're not considered to be that important. The only place that we finally see a high priest acting the way he should is when we reach Jehoiada, who saves Yoash, I think it was. And yes, you're losing your trousers, honey.
Ah, no, Levi the Fourth. What's going on?
He's having trouble with his trousers. Okay, you want to take them off? Okay, you just give them to me. And now he's picking his nose. Don't pick your nose.
Right.
So basically, that's when we actually start seeing the high priest behaving like a high priest. So really, the leadership of Israel at one point was the high priest together with the king. But the kings were trying to take over. In the ancient world, the king was also the high priest. It was an unusual thing for there's a high priest separate from the kingship. And but this doesn't happen until literally years later when the kingship actually develops.
And it goes on to say in verse 36, and it shall come to pass that everyone who is left in your house will come and bow down to him for a piece of silver and a morsel of bread and say, please put me in one of the priestly positions that I might have a piece of bread. So what is he saying? That they'll be impoverished? They'll be in poverty? What?
Yeah, he's basically saying, because you know, if you remember, the priests, it goes like this. Israelites had their land. Levites mm-hmm. had the little cities and the tithing that was given to them. Tithe mm-hmm. officially actually goes to the Levites. And then the priests have everything that was given to the temple. So that was their income. And weren't too many priests around. I mean, unlike you have today, if you open up a phone book here in Israel and you look up the name Cohen, just that name, there'll be hundreds, if not thousands, of names. That name will appear hundreds, if not thousands, of times. And at one point in the Second Temple period, there were like piles and piles of priests. And today, these days, I think if I remember correctly, there are more people who are considered to be descendants of Aaron than people who are Levites. And there was this ongoing joke for years in my grandfather's synagogue about the fact that when they used to go, there's this Jewish practice that before the priests, before the Kohanim do a priestly blessing, they wash their hands. So Levites, you know, as a memory of the practice in the temple, it wasn't the way it was done, but as a memory of the service of the Levites, because this is the only thing really left from temple service that's left for the priest, the priestly blessing. There's this whole hand washing thing that's taken from the Zohar, so take it with a grain of salt. But essentially, there was always this ongoing joke that my grandfather and another family were the only Levite families in the synagogue, and they go wash their hands. This long line of Kohanim, and there's like 2-3 Levites standing there washing their hands. And it doesn't make sense. It has to be the opposite. So this whole discussion about are they really Kohanim, and there's this whole story that mentioned about families which were made into Kohanim and families which were rejected from the priesthood. It's a big, big mess. And then now there's the whole gene project that they're checking people's gene patterns and everything. And they discovered there are quite a few people out there that don't have what's called the Cohen gene. And
the J1 and J2.
The J1
but
and
we're going to be talking... We're going to talk about that at some stage because obviously the whole Zadok thing comes up fairly soon. And we were going to go into, I was quite ambitious when we began, Yoel, because I thought we were going to get chapter 3 done as well and get into the first verse of chapter 4, but that's not going to happen.
So I just want to mention, if we're already dealing with priesthood, I just want to mention another thing. It mentions it twice. It says in verse 18 that Samuel was a servant before the Lord, and he's a young man wearing an ephod, and then it mentions again when he tells him that he tells him here in verse 28 to carry an ephod before me. So it looks as if an ephod is some kind of priestly garment. So why is Samuel wearing one of these things? And then we also have the sons of, we mentioned this already before, the sons of David were an ephod as well. So it's probably not the ephod, the famous ephod mentioned that also carries the breastplate, but it's some kind of, it's probably mentioned as an ephod because, first of all, this is an interesting piece of information. Men usually walked around just with a skirt. There was no shirt on top.
Hey.
Men just wore a skirt around their waist, down to their knees or beyond. And covering the chest area and the back area was something that was maintained for rich people and important people and kings and priests. Hmm. So it could be that what it mentions in ephod here is, unlike the clothing everyone wore, this was a type of clothing that they also were able to wrap around their chest, cover their arms, cover their chest and back. And that might be the issue of the ephod here. Because it's also mentioned as an ephod bad, which means a linen ephod. This thing was white. So it has nothing, probably has nothing to do with the official ephod used by the high priest. But it's named an ephod because the ephod was like a, not even, probably not an apron, but more, Josephus describes it more of a warrior's upper protective gear, which means it covered the chest and the back. So this might be it. Okay. This might be what we're looking at.
Okay, that's interesting. Listen, before we go, Yoel, I wanted to, because we mentioned before about the fathers instilling in their children the way of God and ensuring that they walk in his Torah, that God chose Abraham because he knew that he would command his household after him. And it reminds me, of course, as well, that here you are, Hebrew in Israel, and just a reminder to the listeners, Hebrew in Israel is the Facebook page. You can go there and engage in the information there. Also, HebrewinIsrael@gmail.com is the – that was the sound of – Levi the Fourth dropping something.
he's dropping a wooden toy here, Kapla, it's called. We're working on a website as well. Me being very busy and my laziness. Oh, there's already a website. The technical part of it, building it and everything, already stands. And there's already a format and everything. It's just an issue of now contacting a server and actually putting all that information up there. Hopefully I'll find some time to do it. At the moment, I'm dealing with a lot of things. So
it's coming along. But your father is a rabbi, right? Right. He obviously instilled in you a sense of Torah and brought you up as best he could.
At least he tried. I mean, I kind of rebelled against some of the stuff that he told me throughout the years, but he was also always very encouraging of self-thought. I mean, my father basically analyzed each one of my brothers and basically said, well, you're like this, you're like this, and he always encouraged me to think.
Mm-hmm.
So my father basically did, I think, that one of the most important things. He basically said, also allow yourself to think for yourself. Don't just go with what people, just what people dictate. Mm-hmm. And analyze things by yourself. And he actually always encouraged me to do that, which probably resulted with something he was not expecting. But my father is also an educator. He holds a master's degree in education and also holds a rabbinic certificate that allows him to function as a communal rabbi, answering sometimes serious questions. Certain fields he never really went into because they're not it's a lot of work, and it's not something he has to deal with every day basis. So he learned everything has to do with kosher food, everything to do with Shabbat, mm-hmm. the regular everyday life things that have to be dealt with. And he runs a synagogue in the United States. Mm-hmm. And my plan is to go and visit him.
I know, because now we talked about this early when we were doing Judges, or it was way back.
Joshua, I think it was.
Because he wasn't well, right? He wasn't that well. We mentioned to the listeners, and some of the listeners very, very kindly and generously contributed to your plane ticket and to the cost of your passport and paperwork and that sort of thing, which has all come together quite nicely, the passport and the itinerary. So that's good. Do we know exactly when you're going? If I understand, you're going in January, right? Just to bring the listeners up to date.
Yes.
So he's over in the States, right?
Yeah, he's over in the States. I'm planning to fly in January. Yeah, people really, really helped. It was pretty amazing. I mean, I actually made sure that money's put aside and it covers. Was trying to finalize with a travel agent tickets and stuff like that because we're struggling with the dates a bit because I'm supposed to fly out there with my brother, and my brother is single, so he can take care of himself. But we said that we were going to fly out together, and it's also part of it is also I'm going to my brother's wedding. There's four of us, and I'm the only one married, and now my baby brother is getting married in the United States. And in my wedding, for example, except for my older brother, there was no one there for me. My older brother was the one who walked with me to the chuppah. He was there instead of my father, and we had my parents on the cell phone. And instead of my mother, a very, very good family, very good friends of mine, who were my foster family for a year, and really tried to help me as much as they could, were the ones who, the wife actually walked with my wife to the chuppah. And so here, we're trying to like mend a kind of a cycle of you know, my family and I actually being disconnected from one another with distance. So this is a very, very important visit. It's the first time I actually go to the United States. Will be the first time the family will be reunited in over 12 years. So this is not just going to visit my family. There's a lot of landmarks here that have to be dealt with. It's my brother getting married when I was married. None of my family was there. No one could come. Now, you know, finally being everyone together, spending a Shabbat together and everything, and just being there as a family now, you know, it's a big, big emotional thing, and this is why my from the depth of my heart, my thanks goes out to all these people who helped with this because this is pretty massive for me, at least, you know, as a person who really upholds the concept of family and has his own family and tries to keep it, you know, tight as possible with every member of the family, so we're always together and we're always communicating. This is a big thing for me. So this is literally
a milestone, right? It's a big family milestone. And so not only do you get to go and see your dad, who you haven't seen for like 2.5 years, who's not really that well, but you also get to attend the wedding of your brother. Is there also, because you made mention of this, are you toying with the idea? Are you gonna have some days to spare where you might be able to catch up with some fellowships, maybe some speaking appointments? Is that a possibility in the New York area?
It's a possibility, but the only way I can do that is, I don't even like saying this, the only way I can do that is if I find more money to find someone who can babysit my children. That's basically it. I'm actually very limited here because my wife works a full-time job. She's out of the house. It's 6:45 in the morning. She gets back at 4:30 in the afternoon. She works very, very hard, and she comes back home and she takes care of other things while I'm working, because most of my work is in the afternoon and evening. And she really keeps the house up. I mean, yesterday, and she looked at me and said, you know, I'm tired, and said, okay, so go to bed. No, I'm mentally tired. I need to go out and visit someone. I said, go ahead. And she went out, and I dealt with the house for 3-4 hours. I just let her go out, just go and area. So she really, I can't really throw this at her unless I find a way, and it's becoming difficult because we live in an area where everyone works. No one's really at home most of the time, and everyone has a job. So no one's really at home to, you know, I can't really hire someone to do this. And so it's kind of difficult. I mean, I probably can find someone, but it's going to cost a lot of money. So I just prefer to fly for a short time. I'm anyhow going to be visiting New York because I've never been to the United States, and New York is like a symbol. You know, you speak with Israelis, and they always speak about, I think it's Miami, it's New York, Miami. What is it? San Francisco or something? There's like specific places everyone talks about. So I said maybe I'll just go down to New York and see, and you know, I might have some time here and there. I mean, I have friends from the West Coast, and they know who they are for listening to this. They really want me to visit, and I'm trying to find a way of doing that as well. But it's flying inside the United States and another ticket. It's not that simple.
They're going to have to stay. People have to stay tuned. If there's a possibility for that, and it sounds like obviously you've got commitments at home that you can't be away for too long. But if there's a speaking opportunity for you to speak to a fellowship or a congregation somewhere, we'll certainly keep listeners up to date for those who are in that area. But in any case, if you want to meet the great Yoel, you'll be able to go on the tour with Keith and myself, the 3T's tour to Israel, which there is a button you can click on the right-hand side of the website, the Israeli flag there will take you to the details. Keith Johnson and myself, we will at some stage When it is convenient, we'll be catching up with you, my friend, in the land, and that'll be an experience. But in any case, that is the update. That's the update. So, you know, I'm glad that you're going to be able to get there in January.
So, again, from the depths of my heart, I want to thank everyone, whoever you are, because it's... John's refusing to give me names. Whoever you are out there, thank you very, 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 very much. You have no idea how happy my father was when I told him that I'm going to be able to pay for a ticket. And he asked me how, and I told him. And he was like, wow. He was like, these are amazing people. And I said, yes, they are.
Amazing. They are amazing.
So whoever you are, thank you. Thank you.
We have the best listeners. So next week, my friend, you and I, we're going to kick off from chapter 3. I thought we were going to do chapter 3. We're going to do chapter 3 yes. next week in Light of the Prophets with Yoel Ben Shlomo. Hebrew in Israel is the Facebook page. And until then, next week, my dear listeners, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of the Father's word. Shalom.
Shalom. Kol Tov. Thank you.